big old round of applause. Come on, guys.
Oh. Wow. Yay. How many of you guys are ready for Mr. Donald Miller? Woo! In the house, live and in person. Now, I want to set this up real quick. I want to invite my friend Don Schmidt to come to the stage. Come on up here, Don. I want to welcome everybody who is here on live stream. We're live streaming this because Donald Miller is about to bring something brand new to you. Special. Come on up here, Don. I want to set this up with a story.
Lizzie is watching.
Hey, Lizzie from Amsterdam. Are the kids watching?
They're asleep.
They're asleep. Okay. All right.
They better be.
Are you kids asleep? All right. So,
thank you.
As the story goes, once upon a time, of course, Donald Miller's book, Story Brand, Building a Story Brand, literally changed the way that I write, changed the way that I communicate. Almost everything that I write nowadays, I use the story brand, the brand script, right? And the seven parts of the brand script. And so I wanted to get certified. Don wanted to get certified. He's in Amsterdam. And I want to talk about how we met first and tell the story of how we met real quick.
Yes. So I was on Tom Zichter's list because I was on Automobile University for years. Yeah. And he was talking about, we want to sit, you want to sit?
You can sit, you can stand, you I'll can walk, stand. You can run. Whatever you want to do.
Yeah, so he mentioned Howard's name in the email. And so I figured if the Zichler Corporation is endorsing somebody, it must be good. And so I bought your books. And that's where I had this fire growing in me to start a business. So that's where it started. I finally came here in February 2016, and I thought, this is so good. We had started our online marketing agency by then. And yeah, we did. So you always say, if you have a business but you don't make a profit, it's just a hobby. We had a hobby. So we needed some coaching. And then you came to Amsterdam. Yep. Together with Tom Zichler. We invited you to speak. We had this conference.
Yeah.
And then we were walking in The Hague. I think we just had a Starbucks coffee. And you said, so tell me about your business. How much money are you making? And I was afraid to say it. I thought, if I'm going to tell Howard how much money I'm making, this is the last time I see this guy. So I told him, I said, we did 20,000 euros this year. And his face was still the same.
It was September, by the way.
Yeah, it was September. Yeah. And so he began to ask me questions like a good coach. You know, he doesn't give advice. He asks questions. So Howard was asking me questions, and he said, man, we need to change some things in your sales process and in your products. And I did. I immediately did. So I came home, told Lizzie, I said, we need to sign up. She said, how are we going to pay for it? I said, I don't know, but we just have to do it.
Sign up for coaching.
Yeah, sign up for coaching. Yeah. So I remember standing before the Hilton Hotel in Soestduinen, and with trembling hands, I gave this piece of paper, and Howard said, sure. What are you afraid of? I said, I don't know. He said, how much clients do you need to pay for this? I said, three. He said, well, go get them. And you left.
Left the country.
So that's when we started building the business.
And then?
Well, the next year we did over 100,000 euros, and then it grew to 250, 500, 750, and last year it was 1.1 million.
From 20,000 to 1.2 million. All right, so now I pick up the story where we're talking about going and getting certified by Donald Miller in StoryBrand in Nashville. And we were looking at different dates, and he really wanted to go in December, I think it was. And I was like, I'm going to be in Cancun with Dr. Robert Rome. And so I really can't go. And it's like the only time that he could really go, so he's going to go without me. Well, lo and behold, my trip to Cancun canceled. And you know how many weeks of the year I have that I have nothing scheduled?
None.
So it was a sign. So Don and I go to Nashville. We meet Donald Miller. We get certified in Story Brand. And I'll let you tell the rest of your story, what happened from there. So what happened with Story Brand with you?
So Donald Miller said, let's do a contest. Who's going to be the fastest in getting their money back from the program, the investment? So back on the plane, I asked the steward, can I have a bigger chair so I have room to work? And I worked like 10 hours straight.
On the plane?
On the plane. I made a presentation because I wanted to win the contest. My schedule was a little bit off, so I had to get off the plane, go to a meeting, and present. And so I presented this new presentation that I built with the Story Brand wording, starting with the problem, etc. And this guy, this owner, sits before me and said, well, you know, from all the three marketing agencies, we actually already made a choice for another marketing agency. You're only here out of courtesy for one of your clients who said, we need to talk to you. But after seeing your presentation, we need to think about it. Next day, he calls me, and we had this 140,000 euro deal. That's when we flew back to Houston in February, and then Donald asked me, so how long did it take for you to get the money back? I said, one day. And then Donald said, one day? Let's put this on video so I can tell the team because they want to hear about it. So, but, you know, the game changer of implementing Story Brand in your business, if you haven't done so, please do, because it really makes all the difference. So that's where it started. And then we had this COVID thing. So that's when we made a video and asked Donald Miller, you know, why don't we build something in the Netherlands?
So you are the exclusive Story Brand certification agency.
Yes.
In the Netherlands?
Belgium
and Luxembourg.
Yes, sir.
Right?
The Benelux.
Benelux, that's right. Not only that, did you co-author a book?
Yeah, kind of.
So
Donald Miller wrote it, but Donald told me, he said, do me a favor, when you translate the book in Dutch, put your name on it. And I felt a little bit weird about it because I didn't write it. But he said, no, do it because, you know, you need to build the brand. And so I got my picture and my name on it, and it really, you know, the book is really the thing that grows Story Brand.
So building a Story Brand in Dutch with Donald Miller and Don Schmidt. How do you like that? Is that crazy good or what? So then what happened with me was Donald Miller and I are talking, and Don goes, thinking about starting a coaching program. I said, awesome. Can I be first? Because I'm the first Ziegler Legacy certified trainer. I'm the world's first John Maxwell team member. And I got to be first. So I said, sure. He kept his promise. And I became the very first Business Made Simple coach and built a phenomenal relationship with Don. We're great friends now. I was just in Nashville recently. The reason that he's here today is because he has a new book out. It's called How to Grow Your Small Business, a 6-step plan to help your business take off. I bought 300 of these, and so we have them here, and we have some news for you. First, Don's going to come and share this model, this framework with you. It is truly phenomenal. It's a great program. Let's welcome Donald Miller to the stage to talk about how to grow your small business. Yay.
Thanks, you guys. I don't know about you guys, I just learned something really valuable, and that is if you ask a stewardess for a bigger seat because you have some work to do, they give it to you. Don, you passed right over that without sharing the rest of us how to do that. Really, really awesome to be with you guys today. I grew up in the area, so it's always wonderful to be back in Houston. I know most of you aren't from Houston, but it's great to be back. The likelihood of me being here probably 12 or 13 years ago, and I mean at a business conference talking about business, it would be zero. If you knew me 12 years ago, you would say, no, that guy's never going to run a business. I was 100% artist. And what I mean by that is usually there are three people at the top of a company, or the three people usually are the artist, the entrepreneur, and the operator. Have you ever heard this? Raise your hand if you've heard this. So the entrepreneur is the one who's always, you know, able to kind of smell where the money's at and smell what's profitable and figure out what to do. Their focus of attention is going to be money, which is really important. You have to have that because business eats cash. The operator is going to obsess with processes and what people are doing, what everybody's job is. And then the artist in this context, in a business context, is usually going to be obsessing about products, right? Content, products, maybe a little marketing and those sorts of things. I grew up, and my first career, if you will, was just as a writer. And I wrote memoirs. I did not write business books. And I wrote about seven of them. The second one took off and sold a ton of copies. And after that, the publisher kept coming to me saying, we want another memoir. And by the seventh one, I honestly think if you write your eighth memoir, you are a clinical narcissist. And so I just called him and I said, look, nothing else has happened. Right? I don't have, like, I went camping. I might have seen a bear. That is half a page. Like, we had to figure something else out. And they agreed, and I'd been studying story and story structure in order to write all these stories, and I just fell in love with story concept as a structure. I just think it is so unbelievably powerful. And Accenture, that giant consulting firm, called and said, hey, will you help us figure out a project management curriculum using all this narrative structure that you're talking about? I thought, that's fascinating. You know, so I did that and then thought, well, this actually parallels a marketing filter really, really well. Now, if I told you I'm writing a book about ancient narrative structures and how they lay over to create a marketing filter for small business, how many copies of that book do you think is going to sell? Not including the three my mother buys. It's going to sell five, right? I'm going to buy one, and then I'm going to find out whoever bought the other one and thank them. But it didn't. It did really well. And that put me in an interesting place because now I've got a second career in this business space, but I am an artist. I am not wired to run a business. I am wired to make money. I enjoy that. But I'm wired to create products. And the products ended up being so popular and so needed that I ended up with about a $3.5 million small business. That was a blast. It was so fun to do that. But I got to tell you, this was, 8 years ago or so, I did not know what I was doing. I felt like I was making it up as I went along. So raise your hand if you've ever felt like you were making it up as you went along. All right, there's the honest people are raising their hands, right? So that's how I felt. Now, my wife, I got married late. I got married at 42. I spent until I was 40 or so just loving being a memoirist and all that kind of stuff. And then met my wife. And there's something about deciding to get married that also, like, parallels with the decision to become a responsible human being. Guys, do you remember that moment? Yeah, it's like, oh my word, like, I can't live like this. Mainly because my wife said, oh my word, you can't live like this. This is incompatible with any other human being. I had a chocolate lab that would go swimming in the river in Portland and then come back and sleep in my bed. My wife was like, well, there's things that have to change. And my wife called Lucy, my chocolate lab, my first wife. And she kind of was, even though dog-human relationships are frowned upon in our society. But that's a whole other political message that I doubt Howard will agree with. Anyway, but the point is, now I'm an artist and I'm running a company and it's doing really well. We moved to Nashville, Tennessee to be in a little bit more central location. Saves me a bunch of travel days and it's closer to Betsy's family. And we moved into this little house there in Nashville, and the neighbor told me, he said, listen, if you ever see somebody running through this neighborhood and police are chasing him, that's the governor. I said, what are you talking about? I said, the governor jogs through this neighborhood. The executive residence is like, you know, a mile away. And just so you know, that's going to happen. I'm like, well, that's fascinating. Well, I just kind of forgot about it, forgot that the governor's, we lived in the poor side of the governor's neighborhood. And somebody called me and said, hey, Don, I'm bringing some friends to town. We're going to talk about Israeli-Palestinian relationships. And I'd just been over in Israel studying some of that stuff. And we're going to do a little, you know, a little forum. Can we do it in your living room? Would you just call some influential people and have them be there to hear this? Well, I didn't know any influential people in Nashville. We just got there. But I thought, well, the governor lives in the neighborhood. So I emailed the governor's office and said, hey, my name is Don. I'm the governor's neighbor. And we're going to talk about Israel and Palestine. I mean, just why not, you know? And so this thing happens, and I'd forgotten that I invited the governor, and he walks in the door. And so I leaned over to my wife, and I said, Google the governor of Tennessee's name. Because I have no idea who this man is. And, you know, had at least one more drink before I got around to shaking his hand. And we ended up becoming friends. I mean, this is very different than Texas, you know, or California or anything. Tennessee is, it really is like this a little bit. We ended up becoming friends. And Governor Haslam had scaled up his father's business, Pilot Fuels, into the billions. And then ran for governor. Now he owns the Nashville Predators. And I think just yesterday he signed up as the chairman for, I think, Tim Scott's presidential campaign out of South Carolina. Really, really wonderful. My kind of Republican, a moderate Republican. I tend to think the two problems in America are the extreme left and the extreme right. They both drive me nuts. So I kind of like that middle ground, and that's kind of where he lives. We got to be friends. In fact, it was really comical because I'm not governor material. And he would say, Don, come up over to the mansion. I got an hour tonight. And I drive my 1974 Volkswagen Thing, because he liked that. He liked the way it looked. So I go, oh, I'm going to take the Thing out. And one night I'm driving up the long driveway at the governor's mansion, and it backfires. And I thought, I'm going to get my head blown off of this thing. Anyway, so we became friends. And right after he left the governor's office, we were standing around in my driveway. And he was always a fan of Story Brand. He'd read it. He let me write one of the State of the State speeches for him. He didn't use it, but he let me write one. He did use one of my lines, and I'm so proud of it to this day. He said, God bless Tennessee. And I thought, I wrote that. I wrote that. Anyway, and we're talking, and at the time, the sort of consulting side of the business and all that kind of stuff, we were doing about $3.5 million, which to me was just an enormous amount of money. And he said, how big do you want this to get? I will never, ever forget. We're standing in my driveway. He said, how big do you want this thing to get? And I said, you know, Governor, I'd love for it to get to $100 million. And for the first time, the governor could not hide the fact that he did not believe in me. he had such a poker face. He's a politician, right? But he just kind of looked at me, and I could tell in his eyes, like, that ain't happening. And I said, Governor, what do you think? And he said, well, you know, Don, anything is possible. God does miracles. but he said, listen, if you want that to happen, you are going to have to, quote, professionalize your operation. That's what he said to me. And I had never heard that phrase before, but it rang true. I mean, I just thought what he was saying was chaos anchored. Kind of like my wife when we got married. This is not going to work for much longer. How many of you resonate with that idea? You've built something successful, and what I said to my wife one night, I said, honey, I feel like I have built a machine that I am trapped inside of. How many of you feel like you've built a machine that you are now trapped inside of? Now, keep your hand raised if the reason you built it was because you wanted freedom. and you didn't realize. And now you're so excited about something that's you're gonna get started on Monday morning, and you get a call on the way to the office, and it says, "Hey, so and so gave their 2-week notice today, and you just got hijacked." And doesn't that happen all the time? So that was what was starting to happen to me. The money was flowing. I was really grateful for that. But I felt like I was on one of those game shows where there's like $5 bills blowing around inside a phone booth, and you're just trying to grab everything you can and put it in here, and then they grab the rest of it and put it in the tax account and all that kind of stuff. That's more or less how it felt. And so for the next about 5 years, the governor and I would meet every once in a while whenever he had time, and it was very kind to be in that relationship. But he was also mentoring a bunch of other small business owners. And so over that time, I would interact a little bit, and I was trying to figure it out. Now, what I wish the governor could have done, I wish he could have handed me a book and said, "You've got to professionalize your operation," and then said, "Here's how to do it." But, he had scaled his company into the billions. He'd probably forgotten all the stuff that they had to do really early on. And so I was more or less figuring it out by myself. And one night I was up in my office, and an interior designer had come and designed the bookshelf behind me, because I put a camera on there. And I'm not an interior designer, but she kind of designed this bookshelf behind me. And she put a little airplane model on there. I'm not a big airplane guy, but there was an airplane. I picked it up one morning. I said, "This is very interesting. The marketing of your business is like the propeller. Like, you got to get the thing moving forward. And the plane, the wings of the plane, are kind of like your products. You got to sell something to get lift. And the body of the airplane is kind of like your overhead. And if it gets too big, the plane's going to crash." This is really sort of interesting. And I began to use that kind of metaphor as a filter for not just operating my company, but being able to sort of reconstruct it and rebuild it the right way, which, by the way, is a luxury. If you're at the point where you're saying, "Okay, we've got to rebuild this company and do it the right way," it's actually a success story, because you got there, right? You got to the point. And so I actually do believe that the first phase of startup is largely chaos. I mean, you are just diving for dollars. And the day one, you're diving for a dollar, and then you make a little more money. The day, 2 years in, you're diving for $5, and then you're diving for $25, and you're looking for the bigger ones. And that's kind of how business works. And so I totally get that. But as we began to grow, the actual metaphor stuck with me. And so I realized, well, we need to create some frameworks that help us operationalize the six parts of our business. And the first part is the leadership. That's your cockpit. And if you think about it, I got on an airplane this morning. I'll get on an airplane about 2 hours after I step off this stage. And what the pilots are going to do when they get that airplane going is they're going to enter the coordinates into that flight computer. And then everything else is going to be reverse engineered from those coordinates. Tonight we're going to go to Nashville. Southwest Airlines is going to program that little thing. And then they're going to say, "Okay, here's where we're going. How much fuel do we have on board? Are the right people on board? Are the flight attendants, right flight attendants?" Everything is reverse engineered from where we're going. Now, to me, this is about mission statement and guiding principles. And once you have your mission statement and guiding principles, you can reverse engineer everything from there. I won't get into it. It's in the book. You're going to get a copy of the book here in a little bit. But I think where people make the most mistake as it relates to the mission statement and guiding principles is they actually don't establish an economic vision for the organization. What I mean by that are hard numbers. This is how much money we are going to make as part of your mission statement. I think most mission statements are just forgotten, right? I was in a conference room with a bunch of executives in Nashville not very long ago, and the whole C-suite is sitting around the conference room, and we were talking a little bit. They asked me about the mission statement, and they were clearly very proud of their mission statement. I mean, the CEO said to me, "This whole group did a 48-hour retreat, and we wrote our mission statement about 5 years ago. And, so our mission statement is great." And I said, I don't know your mission statement, but I doubt it. I doubt it's actually working very well." And he's kind of offended. He said, "No, it's working awesome. It's painted on the wall outside of this conference room." And I said, "That's awesome." So I looked over at the chief financial officer, and I confessed I did choose the CFO. And I said, "Hey, were you at that 48-hour retreat?" And he said, "Yes, I was." And was that an amazing time? It was just an amazing time. I said, "What's the mission statement?" And he didn't know, right? Because it's a flowery piece of poetry written for lawyers. And I said, hey, listen, here's my take, and I could be wrong. I think if you've forgotten the mission statement, you've forgotten the mission. And it's pretty easy to forget it when it's just not a memorable, measurable thing. And so my write this down. My formula for a really good mission statement that really got my team completely aligned is this. We will accomplish X by Y because of Z. And that's it. We will accomplish X by Y because of Z. Now, if you do have a mission statement that you love and you don't want to go back and tell your team we're going to do a new mission statement, just keep your old mission statement and call this a goal statement, right? But I promise you, if you use that formula, your goal statement will take over your mission statement. And your entire team will align around this goal statement even more than they do the mission statement. So we will accomplish X by Y because of Z. So X are three economic objectives. Three. And I literally mean we're going to sell 400 units of this, 600 units of this, and 2,000 units of this. Why three? I wish we could have 7 or 8 or 10, but all the studies show that the human brain has trouble prioritizing more than three things. And so what you want to do is figure out what three things, if you sold more of them, and they could be divisions of the company, right? I mean, you could end up, if you have a pet store, you could end up saying, you know, pet food is going to increase by 30% or whatever. But what you want to do is pick the things that, according to the Pareto principle, the 80%, the 20% of your products that make 80% of your profit. And what we're going to do to grow the business is we're going to focus on three things at a time. And when we accomplish those, we're going to change them out for three other things. But we're going to focus on three things. When you do this with your team, when you sit there and say, hey, what are the three main ways that we make the most of our money? And what would it look like to set a goal if we're going to see 50 to 70% increase in each of those three over the next 2 years? Well, all of a sudden, you have an economic mission. You've got coordinates entered into the flight computer that are specific. What if you got on an airplane? I'm going to get on a Southwest airline flight here in a second. And I'm getting on the airplane, and the pilot's standing there in the door, smiling at everybody. I said, hey, where are we going today? And he says, east. I said, well, east where? I don't know, man. We're just going to go east. We're going to land somewhere out east. Right? I'm getting off of that airplane. Because it's just not specific enough to drive action. Right? It's got to be specific. And you've got to be able to measure whether or not you are actually accomplishing it. The second that we did this, and I'll just share ours with you, we will have 900 StoryBrand certified guides, 500 Business Made Simple certified coaches, and 18,000 people in our online platform by January 1 of 2024. That's our mission statement. That's the first two parts of our mission statement. When we actually define that, all of a sudden, my sales team, my marketing team, my leadership team had something to measure. And I would get a call. Hey, Don, we are 10% behind our coaching goal. Well, we're 50% ahead of where we were last year, but we're 10% behind school. So what do we need to do? I don't know. We were talking about looking at the landing pages and maybe sharpening things up or looking at the email campaigns, or maybe you can bring it up in the podcast or something like that. You can now make decisions because you know whether or not you are ahead of or behind an actual economic goal. And it became a filter. All of a sudden, my leadership team has a filter. I will never forget, 2 weeks after we created this mission statement, we're sitting around in the conference room, and we're kicking around an idea. And it seems like a pretty good idea. And then one of my team says, hey, if we do this, it doesn't actually positively affect any of our three economic objectives. Do we even want to do this? And the whole team just kind of went, no. We're wasting our time. Holy rats. We just got hijacked by some idea that has nothing to do with the things that we needed to accomplish. And so we dropped it. And all of a sudden you have a filter, right? We're not flying to Nashville, via Topeka, Kansas. We're gonna go straight. It takes less fuel to actually get there. The why is your deadline. And I think your deadline should be out. If you wrote your mission statement today, I think your deadline in that goal statement should be out 2 years. Anything beyond 2 years, psychologists have shown that anything out beyond 2 years, your brain processes as a different human being. your brain has trouble realizing that 2 years you will still be on the planet. So as a goal, if I'm going to do this in the next 2 years, it's about as motivating as saying my uncle's going to do this in the next 2 years, because you think of yourself as a different person 2 years from now. It's too far removed from where you're standing right now. And so we set two-year deadlines, and we are getting closer and closer, by the way, to our two-year deadline, and you wouldn't believe how much the urgency goes up, especially when there's compensation and bonus structures based on whether or not we hit these goals, right? And all of a sudden, we've got 8 months to figure this out and to hit these goals, and people just start ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. And sometimes the pressure gets a little high, and you find out who can operate under pressure and who can't, you know? And so people kind of look for other jobs if they're not down with this, which we need them to do, right? And then the Z is X, Y, by Y, because of Z, is your reason. It's what Simon Sinek calls your why. And our why is because every small business owner deserves the help they need to grow a small business. So we will have this many of this, this many of this, this many of this by January 1 of 2024 because every small business owner deserves the help they need to grow a small business. That has been an incredibly powerful goal statement for us. And you enter that into the flight computer and you begin to reverse engineer all of your business strategy from that mission. The next thing that we figured out was our marketing. And you are familiar if you've read Building a Story Brand, and I've talked about it in this group before, how that works. But you've got to clarify your marketing message, and you've got to create, if you can, a sales filter. And you can learn that from Sherry here in this group. Then we're going to talk about sales. So once you get your right engine, your marketing fired up, which I do believe usually should come first, then your sales engine needs to be ramped up. And I'm going to go into depth. We're going to zoom in on sales for the rest of this talk after I finish this airplane analogy. But the big thing with sales is we have got to learn to invite customers into a story and stop actually trying to convince them to buy our products. Sales is all about understanding that your customer is the hero trying to solve a problem, and you can help them solve that problem with the use of your products. And when you begin to think of sales that way, it's amazing how many more sales you close. Then the wings of the airplane represent the products. Your products are what you sell in order to get lift. And this often is where there's just a ton of hidden money. In fact, if you look at my small business, and I'm sure yours is similar, when you say a hockey stick of revenue growth, it's usually associated with the release of a new product. And so many of us will release a product and we do really well with it, and then sales kind of flatline and maybe they even decline a little bit. And we believe the answer is actually to push harder on what already exists, when it might be to sit around the conference room with some of your team and say, hey, what else can we sell? You know, for instance, I had a guest on my podcast recently, and two women out of Salt Lake City. They ran a dance studio, and they wanted to know how to make more money. They said, Don, you know, we're at capacity. We're doing super well. We have a waltzing class. We have some introductory ballet classes. We have a breakdancing class. You know, they kind of went through all that stuff. And we think the way to grow the small business is to open up a franchise across town. So now we've got one right here, and we're going to open up another one across town and try to double our revenue with that. Okay. What I'm hearing is we're going to massively increase the body of the airplane and hope the plane can keep going. So I don't love that idea, right? And so I said, talk to me about the financials on this. How much does it cost for me to take a breakdancing class? One, you're going to have to pay me to do that. But regardless, how much does it cost to take a breakdancing class? He said, well, it's $250. It's a six-week class, you know, once a week for about an hour. And I thought, $250? How many people are in the class? You know, 10 to 30 people. Well, you start doing the math on paying that dance instructor and paying the HVAC bill and paying the rent on that building. And all of a sudden, you realize they got about a 3% profit margin. So the risk on going across town opening a franchise is actually significant at this point. And so we just started daydreaming. Hey, what could you do to not charge $250, but to charge $10,000 for the same amount of work or even less? And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, kid, moms are not going to pay $10,000 for 6 hours of breakdancing for their kids. Okay, so that's out. Moms won't pay that. Who will pay it? I don't know what you're talking about. Nobody's going to pay $10,000 for a breakdance. Now somebody's going to pay it. Who will pay it? And I said, well, will a corporation pay it? Will a business pay it? Well, I don't know. Why would a business pay that? Well, let's keep thinking. Don't stop. What if you went into a business, say a business has 50 employees, you brought your dance instructor there, you taught the business one morning to do some sort of dance in the office, you know, and you get cameras going through the office, that sort of thing. You create kind of a viral video. You would have sort of a team building exercise, and people are always looking for that, right? Just had breakfast next to the guy who started the escape games a little bit ago. That actually started out of Nashville, and the guy was sitting across from us, and he's a big StoryBrand fan. You know, all they do is team building exercises, and they're making tens of millions. I think they have 60 franchises now all across the country. And they're only about 8 years old. I mean, phenomenal success. So people will pay for team building exercises. All right, then it's also a retention play. Because now this group is having fun. They've created some bonding with each other. They've, you know, if you dance together, I guess you bond. You know, so, you know, you kind of have that. And then you've also got a recruiting play, because there's a viral video going out there, so it's going to help you recruit a little bit. And it's a little bit of an advertising play if you put it out on social media. This seems like a fun place to work, so you get somebody's attention. I think a small business might pay $10,000 for that. And she says, well, maybe they will. Now, how much does it cost you to get that $10,000? You bring a facilitator into the room. Is that facilitator working harder to get that done than they would be with a bunch of kids over six different weeks teaching breakdance? She's actually working a lot less hard. So you have to pay your facilitator a little bit less because it gets done quicker, right? It gets done in about 4 hours. You bring in a film crew. Pay the facilitator, I don't know, $750. Pay the film crew, $1,000. You're at over $8,000 profit on this one product. Is that right? She's like, yes. And they implement it, and it worked. Same amount of work, in fact, less. No increase in overhead. Massive increase in profit. That's what you want to sit around with your team. You want to look at the wings of your airplane and say, what are we missing? What are we missing? Because what we do is we get this tunnel vision of we sell this, right? We sell this and we got to sell more of it. And people don't actually want it as much as they used to want it. Just stop. Hold on. Like, get a blank canvas and go, what can we do to charge $5,000 for something that doesn't cost us anything? Well, the question you always want to answer at that point is, what value are we creating? Right, the way we price our products, if we charge $10,000 for something, we want people to make $100,000 within 1 year. We're business to business. So we want a 10x return on people's investment and whatever we do. And we just sit and reverse engineer anything from that. In fact, if you bring me in for we just call it a strategy session. I don't do very many of them anymore. But if you bring me in for a day, my team charges a lot of money for that. And I'll get on the phone with whoever I'm bringing in, and I'll say, or whoever's bringing me in, I'll say, you know, how do you guys make money? I want to make sure it all works, and blah, blah, blah. That sounds good. So, okay, here's the deal. You pay a lot of money for me to come in. If within 12 months you don't make a 10x return on what you paid me, I will write you a check back. Because I'm not going to take your money unless you make a ton of money off of it. Never had to write that check, right? So you figure out how can we, if it's business, how can we make other people money? How can we save people money? How can we give people a better night's sleep? You figure out how to increase the value so that you can charge more. In the flight school that you're going to understand, and part of our flight plan that I'll talk about a little bit later, we actually have something, it's an online tool called a product profitability assessment. And you basically list all of your products, and then you do some calculations to figure out how profitable they are. And then the assessment will actually order your products in the rank of how profitable they are. And then you sit and go, okay, we need to sell more of these profitable products. And probably some of the bottom 10 products, just cut them. Just get rid of them because they're stealing marketing bandwidth and all that kind of stuff. That's how you engineer wings that make an airplane fly. And by the way, the bigger and lighter the wings are, the less the engines have to work. Now let's talk about the body of the airplane. The body of the airplane is your overhead. And most businesses go down because of overhead creep, right? It's those annual bonuses combined with not raising your prices, combined with runaway inflation. Does that sound familiar? Raise your hand if that sounds familiar. The body of your airplane just starts getting bigger and bigger. And then some of your products aren't as interesting to your customer. And what's happening right before your eyes is your wings are getting smaller and smaller. Facebook ads go up, so your ride engine is now working not as well as it used to. Your number one salesperson went off and did something else. You're training a new salesperson, and suddenly your left engine is sputtering smoke. And now you're going to go down. So we have to get pretty darn aggressive about how we manage the body of that airplane. Now, your number one cost is probably labor. Is that right for most of you? Yeah. It's that every 2 weeks, that payroll expense. And have you noticed how big that thing has gotten lately? Okay, so how do you actually make your airplane more lean? Because you'll notice, I mean, you get on these little commuter jets and you're ducking your head and you're sitting in this tiny seat with, I mean, they are shoving everything they can into that little bitty fuselage, it's called. You want to run your business that way. You want to think, and here's how that works. When somebody comes to you and says, Don, you know, culture has changed a little bit, and we think if we actually replace all the desks in the office with ping pong tables, it's going to be really, really awesome, right? And then replace the coffee maker with a keg. It's going to be so great. And, you know, and that's called a private equity funded startup that's going to fail. That's what that's called, right? What you've got to do is figure out how to get more out of your labor, more productivity. So in the book that Howard's going to give you, we created a way to run your business using 5 meetings. Now, that sounds really simple, but it took me more than $500,000 paying consultants to actually figure that out. Because I'm an artist, right? I mean, we kind of have meetings whenever we need to have meetings. Somebody calls me and says, hey, we get together, I had a question about this. That's how I ran the business. And it's no wonder we capped at $3.5 million and I felt like I was trapped inside of a machine. I hired a guy, cost me about $300,000 to spend a year with me, and he installed a Japanese form of management called lean management into our business. And basically, the business is run with 5 meetings. Those meetings are your all-staff meeting. We have that meeting on Monday at 10 a.m. At 10:45 a.m., we go right into the leadership meeting. Everybody signs off of Zoom, and the leaders sign back on. There's a template, by the way, in your flight plan that you'll understand more later for that all-staff meeting. So you can archive everything you've ever talked about in your all-staff meetings. And you can know we brought this up. Let me show you. Your leadership meeting, you take every problem that your leaders are trying to solve and you give it a new section on the leadership template. So you can just scroll through and you archive them whenever those problems are solved. That happens at 10:45. Then there is the department stand-up. So each of your department leaders are going to have a 15-minute stand-up every single morning, except for Monday morning, with all of their departments. That's 15 minutes. It's not a long meeting. And all you're going to do in that 15-minute stand-up is you're going to go over the 3 economic objectives of the organization and the 5 department priorities in order to hit those objectives. And then everybody's going to say, here's where I'm blocked, right? And it's the job of the department leader to get people unblocked. Then there's the personal priority stand-up. That happens once a week with each team member and their department head. How many of you guys have really struggled to make sure that each of your people, especially as your organization grows, are getting the coaching and development that they need on a weekly basis? I mean, that is a pain, isn't it? Yeah, nobody starts a business because they want to run a business. Nobody. We started a business because we want freedom and we love our product and we really fell in love with our customers and we like where we're. And then all of a sudden you find yourself running a business. So we have a personal priority speed check that each of our team members do with their department head, and that has been a lifesaver because everybody's getting the feedback that they need and the encouragement that they need. And we make sure they're just working on the right things. How many of you have ever been on a call, listen to somebody talk about how hard they're working on a project that you killed 2 months ago? Have you been on that call or something like that? I've been on that call. That was really frustrating. So this keeps things like that from happening. And then there's the final meeting is a quarterly performance review. And so every one of your people are going to meet with their department head for a private, about 45-minute meeting in which they go through their priorities and you have a conversation about whether or not they're exceeding their priorities, meeting them, or not exceeding their priorities. How many of you have ever realized, you don't have to raise your hand, how many of you have ever realized that you need to fire somebody because they're doing a terrible job? Okay, how many of you have also realized that they have no idea they're doing a terrible job? Okay, be honest. Who's doing the terrible job then, you or them? Yeah, we are. We're responsible for that. We haven't communicated that or tried to develop them in any way, got involved in a little gossip with the leadership team about what they're up to, that sort of thing. And so the quarterly performance review really allows you to have a track record of, hey, we've met every 3 months for four reviews, and you're not getting this. And we've got actually a paper trail on this. So we've either got to find a place for you to work within, inside this organization, or we need to eliminate your position, or we need to replace you with somebody else, or put you through an employee improvement plan, you know, whatever it is. Here's your employee improvement plan, and here's the severance package. You choose. And by the way, they're going to go with the severance package, right? And that's, and it's just a kindness on our part. And it's also, what we do is we tie that quarterly performance review to their compensation package. And so everybody is eligible for a 3% raise every year. We did do an inflation adjustment that was not a raise, but everybody's eligible for a 3% raise. But if we hit our three economic objectives, everybody's eligible for a 5%. But you're only eligible based on what your quarterly performance review is saying. So some people are going to get the full 5%, some of you are going to get 2% because you're just not achieving expectations. It's a fantastic system. And I am not somebody who micromanages people. Again, I'm an artist. I want my head buried in a book. I'm a nerd. I want to sit at a coffee shop and I want to write books, right? But I meet with the president of my company and we go through this quarterly performance review. And I know enough to say, hey, it can't all be good news, right? I've got to have something to tell him that you, here's how you're going to get better. Otherwise, he's not going to feel like he's being coached. And so I was able to say, hey, I mean, my guy, the president of my company, just does not make mistakes. He is just awesome. He's smarter than me, better than me in every way. And so just be able to write down, hey, I would love for you to be more creative in your job. Like, figure out some things. And he that was like fresh water to him. Don gave him something to work on, you know? And so those conversations are made a lot easier when we have a management system. So I'll introduce you to that in the book. And then there is a piece of software that you'll be introduced to. The software is free, and you can use it. There are templates for every one of these meetings that you can go in and you can fill out, and you can have your team fill out. We're actually working on a button, one button, that if your entire team is on the flight plan, you can hit the button and see what everybody is doing. So you see everybody's priorities inside the entire organization. I invented this button, or asked my team to create it, when I was walking down the hall and I saw James. I only have 30 people on my team. It's not that big of a team. And I saw James, and I knew we had moved James to a different position. And I walked in the conference room after talking to him for 2 minutes, and I said to myself, I have no idea what James does. I know exactly how much money he makes, but I have no idea what he does. And I thought, oh, wow, we have a slightly larger small business than we used to. And I went to call my designer and said, hey, can you make a button that I can press and it tells me what everybody's doing? And he said, we'll start working on it, Don. This is really great. And it turns out James is doing some awesome things, and he's doing great. But that would be a button for you to press and be able to look at everybody's five key priorities and then be able to call over to marketing and say, hey, you guys are working on stuff. I don't think you need to work on it. And they can call back and say, actually, we do because this and this. And you start understanding what everybody in the organization is doing. That's how you keep the body lean. What we want to do when we're running a business and we want to keep the body lean is when you start throwing people out of the airplane, right? We're up at 38,000 feet. We go, hey, too heavy. You got to go. You got to go. Start throwing, you know, chairs, people's pets, everything you can out of the airplane. But what if you actually said, no, what we want is for every dollar that we invest in labor, we get a $5 to $10 return. So if every one of your people is like a stock and they're giving you a return on that investment, the actual airplane will grow large around the body of the airplane and your whole business just gets bigger and bigger. And by the way, this can happen during a recession. In fact, I think in some ways, yes, the headwinds are stronger during a recession, but that sense of urgency and panic actually works in your favor, as long as it fuels a growth plan. So if you make a plan to grow your revenue by 100%, you're going into a headwind, and you only grow by 50% during a recession, is that a success? Yes. That's a heck of a success. But it will not happen without intentionally creating a growth plan. The final part of this airplane is the cash flow system. And I run my business using five checking accounts. It is very much like Mike Michalowicz's plan, Profit First, which is a great book. Have you read Profit First? Raise your hand. Mike is a good friend. Just texted with him today. And he's a wonderful guy. Basically, those five accounts, and I'll share you how I do it a little bit differently here in a second, but those five accounts are your operating account, and hopefully everybody in this room has an operating account that's different than their personal checking account. I did that for about 4 years, and that kind of doesn't work after a minute. But you've got your operating account, then you have your personal checking account, and you want to pay yourself on a salary. So you and your family can budget because you make, I don't know, whatever, you know, $10,000 a month or something like that is what you make. And then your personal checking account, your operating account are different. And then I just want you to open two different accounts. One is called business profit, and the other is called taxes. Have you heard of taxes?
Yep.
Yeah. So you've got, what you want to do then is you have in your operating account 1 month's worth of operating expenses. For me, that's about $250,000. It's more than, it's about $500,000. But every 2 weeks, I get hit for just about $200,000 on my payroll. So I always have to make sure the operating account always has at least about $250. And then every 2 weeks, it kind of does this and rebuilds and does this and rebuilds. You know what I'm talking about? And then what I do is I put a boilover system in there. So anything over $250, depending on how close we are to the middle or the end of the month, I actually remove that money from my operating expense account and I put the money into business profit and taxes. I split it 50-50. So in other words, if I have $350,000 in my operating expense account, I know I can put 50 into business profit and 50 into taxes. And I try to get that money out of my operating expense account as fast as I can. Why? Because you'll spend it. Yeah. If it's in the account, you'll spend it, especially if people see it. Right? You'll spend it. And so what I do then is I have my rainy day fund is my business profit account. And I try to have 5 to 6 months worth of overhead in the business profit account. So I can easily remove money if I get into trouble, payroll's coming up and we haven't quite done super well. I'll move money back from business profit and also taxes. Because as soon as it goes back into business, into the operating expense account, it is now, that it went from pre-tax income to post-tax income, so I can actually move my tax money back. So your tax account is actually a second safety net. It's really nice. Now, my business profit account, when it has 5 or 6 months worth of money in it, operating account, I boil it over into a final account. And that account is just called investment holding. And so when money boils over from my rainy day fund into my business profit, into my investment holding account, that is finally my money. So my money is not in the operating account. My money is in two places. It's in my personal checking account and the investment holding account. Those two accounts are my money. And what I've got to, the reason I did that and use these five accounts is it protects the machine that makes me money. Right? Have you ever gotten a call or have you ever been this person? I have a dear, dear family member who I love very much, and I've been encouraging her for years and years, you have got to start a company. You've got to start a company because you're doing this for $25 an hour and you could be doing it for $250 an hour if you own the business. So she called me one day and she said, I got an opportunity to buy it's a flower shop. Got an opportunity to buy the flower shop. You think I should do it? I said, you should do it. My goodness, you should do it. And so she did it, and Betsy and I went in with a little bit with her and helped her with that. And then she called me one day. She's crying, and she says, I didn't save enough money for taxes, and they're shutting down my account. And so I said, don't worry. I said, this is called an education. It's better than a Harvard degree, what you just got. Yeah. So I'll let it out of the bag here. It's my big sister.
Yeah, that's right.
And I said, now I know what you think of me. You think I'm the snotty kid who eats his boogers, but listen to me. People actually pay attention to me when it comes to this. I said, Jennifer, 5 checking accounts. Let's go through it. You know, if I had told her that before the IRS came knocking, she wouldn't have done it, right? But now she's doing awesome right here in Houston. She's doing awesome. And that money is always set aside for taxes, so you're never surprised by it. Now, here's the great thing. 50% of all profit. By the way, when you move money into your personal checking account, you also have to move the exact same amount of money into taxes. So if you're paying yourself $10,000 a month, you have to pay taxes $10,000 a month. right? And then any money that comes into business profit also has to be split 50-50 in taxes. The great thing is your tax rate is probably like 37%. I mean, if there's a Democrat in the White House, it's like, you know, 39%. And if it's a Republican, it's 37%. It's a joke. It's a joke. You know, the only people who are getting actual tax breaks are Warren Buffett. That's it. You're not. It drives me crazy. Like, we've got to tax the rich. And what they mean by rich is you. Right? They're not actually taxing the rich at all. So we do that, and then it's a little bit over, because even by the time you pay your sales tax and your payroll tax, depending on your state, you can actually, at the end of the year, give yourself some money out of that tax account. But I like having too much in there, because that's the bill that you always get surprised by, right? And so that's how we've been running our money for a long time. I've been doing that for, gosh, about 7 years. And I really mean this. We have never run out of money. I've never not been able to make payroll. I've never been surprised by a tax account. And the real reason, let's be honest, is because Betsy and I are living off a fraction of what the business actually makes. Now, you say, Don, why do you call it investment holding? Why don't you call it your money? Because it's a psychological trick that says, invest this money. Right? Invest it. Go and buy financial products, whatever you want to do. I'm not a financial advisor. I don't know. We do some pretty darn basic stuff. But you can go invest that money. Right now in Nashville, there's 800,000 people moving to Nashville in the next 10 years. What do you think I'm buying? Real estate. We just, 2 weeks from now, we'll close on a house for my mother and father-in-law. And they're like, oh, you're so generous. I'm like, I am. But I'm also going to make $50,000 a year on the equity on that house, right? And free babysitters 1 mile away. So I'm like, yes, I'm very generous. You should be very thankful. Not at all. We're getting the better deal there. You know, so you want to be able, and then what we want to do is we want to live off the money our money makes. So we've got a salary that we're making. But if you want to buy a bass boat, think about the cost of that bass boat. I'm looking at a bass boat room. Think about the cost of that bass boat. What, 20 grand for kind of nice used used? $250,000. Well, you guys are, these are luxury bass boats you guys are talking about. You talking about like Bass Pro Shops has a $50,000 bass boat? Well, you guys have computers now. Artificial intelligence tells you where the bass are. That's cheating. I'm talking about a canoe with a trolling motor. All right, let's say you want a bass boat, a $50,000 bass boat. What is the cost of a $50,000 bass boat? You tell me. $100,000. It's $100,000 because you had to put $50,000 into taxes, right? So it costs you $100,000 of work to get the $50,000 to buy the bass boat. Now, it depreciates 20%. What would it appreciate if you put the $50,000 into an investment? So what's your opportunity cost on the bass boat after 20 years? A lot more money. Now, here's what you need to do. You need to make friends with people who aren't very smart and buy the bass boat. And then for the cost of a cooler of beer, you have the bass boat. That's right. Yeah. So, you know, if we want to start thinking about it that way, that's kind of how we think about it. And the difference between the way Mike does it is Mike says, figure out how much profit you want to make in a year or you're going to make in a year and take the money out at the beginning of the month. The reason I don't do that is because if I did that, I would have too much money left in my account, because some months I'm pulling out $500,000 in profit and the next month I'm not pulling out any. Right? And so I like the boil over system more than the profit first system. Otherwise, they're pretty much identical. And I will never write a book on small business cash flow, because I think Mike has already written. He's done a fantastic job. And again, that book is called Profit First. All right. I don't want to be here with you guys without, you know, actually trying to make you some money. So I want to zoom in on just one of the parts of the airplane. I want to zoom in on sales, because I think this is probably what in this room you need most in order to get a return on your investment. And you paid to be here, and you got on an airplane, and you paid the hotel fee. So let's just set a goal in the room that I want to help you sell something right here in the room that makes you back a significant return on your investment in being here. And then I want to teach you how to do something that you can keep using for the rest of your life. How many of you think that sounds like a good idea? Okay, the last time I did this, and I want you to try to beat them. The last time I did this, it was how many people are in the room? There was 250 people in the room last time I did this. This has got to be about 250, right? Getting close to that. The last time I did this, based on what we did in the room closed $2.4 million worth of sales. Wow. All right, so let's look at what I'm talking about when it relates to sales. The reality is most of us hate to sell. We did not get into the business of selling, right? We got in the business of making products, loving those products, creating stuff, you know, managing people, all that kind of stuff. We don't like asking for money. And I want to take away that fear right now, because I kind of want to give you a different framework on this that actually helps you love to sell. We're going to do this in the form of an email or a letter or whatever that you can send to your entire email database, or you can send to one customer that is sitting the fence. Raise your hand if you have one customer that is sitting the fence on whether or not to buy something from you. Raise your hand really high. Okay, great. You don't have to write the email here in the room, but I want you to take notes so that you can write it tonight, maybe even before you go to bed. And don't overthink it. I'm going to give you a formula for doing that. Okay, here's the metaphor. We've got a river that we've got to cross, and what we want to do in this sales framework, the very first paragraph that we're going to start with, we're going to start with the problem that the customer has. What is the problem that your customer has as it relates to your product or service? And I want that to be the very first thing that you bring up in this email. So we would normally do an email saying, hey, you know, just pinging you on that, what we talked about, you know, have you guys made a decision? The terrible email. Terrible email. The only thing that motivates and triggers somebody to buy something is that they have a problem they're trying to solve. Everybody in this room is actually in the same business. You are problem solvers. And it's the problem that makes you want to buy something that solves the problem. And so what you want to do in that very first sentence or paragraph is articulate very, very clearly the problem that the customer has. So you want to be able to say, hey, Jane, loved playing golf with you the other day. There we go. Informalities out of the way. And we say, by the way, my heart is still breaking from what we talked about, that you were struggling with this. I just don't think you should struggle with that anymore. Right? And get to the problem. Why? Because the problem is the trigger that makes them want to buy your product. It's not the features of the product. It's not the benefit of the product. None of that. Until we state the problem. You guys, I did it in this speech. I walked up here and said, I felt like I'd built a machine that I was trapped inside of. Raise your hand if you feel the same way. I did that specifically for a reason, because it got you to pay attention to the rest of the talk. If I had to come up here and say, my name is Don Miller, and my wife is Betsy, and she's really beautiful, and we have a 22-month-old. Here's a picture of her. You're sitting there going, you're waiting for the speech to get started. And the speech only gets started when the guy up here actually says the problem that you are wanting to solve. And that is because the way your brain works, your brain is a problem-solving supercomputer. It's actually astounding. It is always looking for a problem to solve. In fact, have you ever been in an environment that was very, very peaceful, and people were uncomfortable with that, so they started creating drama? Raise your hand if you've ever been in that environment. Yeah, it's called family. It's called... Raise your hand if you grew up Baptist. Yeah, so that's it. That's the whole thing. Yeah, that's human beings, right? We need problems to solve. We're problem-solving machines. By the way, this is how stories hook you. You ever started like an episode of Ted Lasso or something at 9 o'clock at night? Or, oh, what's the one with Chris Pratt that Amazon put out? What's the one with Chris Pratt? It was like the something list. What is it? Terminal list. Don't do it. You'll lose the whole weekend. right? And then you're like, okay, you're trying to keep your eyes open. We go to bed at like 9:30. You know, we've got a two-year-old at home. We go to bed at 9:30, and I swear, at like 9:29, you wrap that thing up, like, so great, and then they just leave that one little hook. And you're just like, my God, next. You know? Yeah, they hook you with a problem. The problem in story structure is the hook. You know, if I told you a story without a problem, you wouldn't pay any attention to it. And one of the things, if we've got we've just created a room at my office in Nashville. It's a separate room from any of the offices. We're putting four whiteboards on the wall, and we're using painter's tape to structure each whiteboard in the form of a 36 plot point story structure. And we're turning each of those six areas, leadership, into a novel. So you'll be able to just get an audio book and listen to a six-part story that'll teach you how to run a business. Really, really pretty fun to do. But I guarantee you, the most of our time, there's three other writers are sitting around doing this with, most of our time is, what's the problem? What's the problem? It's a female entrepreneur out of New Orleans is our hero. What's the problem? What's she dealing with now, right? And we know that unless we identify that problem really clearly, there's no hook. You'll start seeing this in movies from here on out. There's a scene in the movie. It happens like usually 9 to 12 minutes into the movie. These things are so formulaic. And the scene is called Theme Stated. And the hero or somebody will state the theme of the movie. The most obvious one, Betsy and I were watching like National Treasure 2, I think. And Nicolas Cage, do you remember this? They're in the Antarctic and there's some sort of shipwreck or something. And they discover the shipwreck. And his co-star turns to him and says, they're going to try to steal the Declaration of Independence. And Nicolas Cage says, and we have to stop them. Right? Why would that scene be at the beginning of the movie? It says what the movie's about. And now you have a story question. And the question is, are they going to be able to stop them from stealing the Declaration of Independence? So you have to state that very, very clearly so the entire audience knows that's what this movie is about. That's why you start with the problem. Because basically you're saying to your customer, who is the hero, here is your problem. It's this. And what that does in the mind of the person who's reading the emails, it opens a story loop. And the story loop is, they're absolutely right. How am I going to solve this? Or, I have to solve this. All right, now, the way all human behavior works is the opening and closing of story loops. You are motivated to take action only when a story loop opens in your mind. Hunger is the opening of a story loop. How do you close it? Yeah, lunch. Don't overthink it. Right? Loneliness is the opening of a story loop. Community is how you close the story loop. You know, on everything that you do is opening and closing of story loops. Therefore, if you open a story loop in the first paragraph of your sales email, how do they close that story loop? They buy your product. And so many people come and say, Dom, we're not selling this. And I'll look at their material and say, it's because you're not opening a story loop. Right? There's no reason to buy your product because it doesn't close a specific story loop. So we've got to open that story loop in the very first paragraph or sentence of this sales email. The next thing that we do is pretty obvious. We position our product as the solution to the problem. So the way that you actually close this story loop is you buy this. Jane, my heart broke when we played golf the other day because you're dealing with this thing. You don't have to deal with it. I had 20 customers this month who was dealing with that exact thing, and they bought this, and they're not dealing with it anymore. Now, you haven't closed the story loop for Jane. You just told her how to close it. Does that make sense? Product, problem, and then product as solution. Then what we're going to do is we're going to build a three-step bridge, a plan that gets them from their product to their solution. Jane, here's how we can solve this problem for you, just like we've solved it for all these other people. One, let's get together for an intake session. I want to understand exactly what's going on over there. Next, I want to give you a report on what I would do if I was in your position. Here's all the things you can do to solve this problem. And then third, if you want, I'll hold your hand through the whole thing. We'll get you through this on a retainer basis, or we'll install the product, or whatever that is. buying goes up when there's actually a three-step plan. And the reason is, even though we've got the customer with a problem and you with a solution, they're still not going to buy the product at that point. And the reason is they enter into what's called cognitive dissonance. And so they, you know, this happens to me all the time. You know, somebody will have something, I'm like, that would solve my problem. That does sound really good. And they'll say, well, if you're ever interested, let me know. Well, I am interested. But what I'm waiting for is some sort of clarity about how it's all going to work. What it's going to cost me, how much time it's going to cost. I got to be sure that it's actually going to work out. And so what I say to you is, hey, let me get back to you on that. What does let me get back to you mean? It means, but let me say this. I don't think it means no. I think what it means is I'm going to get some space from you. And when this thing becomes really clear, I'm going to get back to you. The only problem is you can't go home with them and make it clear for them. So it just never gets clear. And so they never call you back. So what you want to be able to do is say, hey, there's some baby steps that you can take to get into this. And it's not that hard. And you remove a lot of that cognitive dissonance, and they are much more likely to buy your product. However, there's still a couple things that we can do to incentivize them to cross that bridge and take those steps. The 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph that we're going to write, and these paragraphs can be as long as a sentence. This is not a long email. Are the negative stakes that are going to happen if they don't buy your product. Jane, I don't want to see you struggling with this anymore. If you don't fix this problem, it is going to get worse. And what does that do? Motivates Jane to get on that bridge. However, 5th paragraph, your life could look like this. It could be happy. You could be not dealing with this problem. Those are the first 5 sentences or 5 paragraphs. Do it however you want. And they also, by the way, they need to be in this order. There's actually a structure to this. And by the way, this is the same structure on a very meta level that is in every single movie you watch, every television show. It's 2,500 years old. Plato wrote it down in Poetics for the first time. This is how the human brain works. This is the language that the human brain speaks. And when you actually write the letter in this order, they don't have to think and try to figure out what you're saying. Then finally, the very last thing that you're going to say in this email is, Jane, it's time to place an order. And you're going to ask for the money. But let's solve this real quick. How many of you love asking for the money? You love it. That's actually pretty good. And those people who just raised their hand have more money than the rest of us. I just want you to know that. They really do, right? I mean, there's other people. There would be a lot more people who would have raised their hand, but they're not here. They're on a boat because they have a lot of money. How many of you, a bass boat? It's bigger than a bass boat. How many of you have ever met a sales representative who is extremely, extremely successful and also dumb as a doorknob? Yeah, some of you are like me. Yeah, you know what they're good at? Asking for the money. That's what they're really good at. So let's actually get good at that really quick. I think the reason we don't want to ask for the money is because we don't want to be a sleazeball, and we also don't want to be, much less be seen as, somebody who's only interested in a transactional relationship. Right? It feels like we're not good human beings. All right, so let's change that. I am that person. I mean, my team often won't let me interact with a client because I will do it for free. Right? And they're like, no, Don, they'll step in front of me, they'll knock me down. I just want to help, right? I'm the artist. And they're like, no, you can't do that. And so this changed, though, for me. Let's see, it was probably about 4 years ago now. Betsy and I were in Israel. We were in Israel on one of these tours. We were helping the nation of Israel message an archaeological dig that they want the world to know about. Sometimes my job is fun. Usually it's plumbers selling plungers, but this one was not. Really fun. So I was like, Betsy, you got to come with me. They're going to take us on a tour of all sorts of stuff underground. It was really a blast. And we're coming back from that business thing, and we're in Tel Aviv, And you know how it is when you're with your spouse in the airport. It's like, hey, will you watch the bags and I'll go walk around, and you watch the bags, I'll walk around. You got 3 hours in the airport. So I'm walking around the airport in Tel Aviv, and there's a jewelry store. You know, these things are just malls these days. The jewelry store, and I saw like a bunch of watches. Now, I had told myself I would buy myself a nice watch when my company hit 10 million. And I couldn't even, I mean, I never thought I would buy that watch. 10 million is huge. I never thought I would have anything like that. Well, we'd hit 10 million 2 years before, right? We were heading toward 18, and I'd never bought the watch. In fact, I bought every member of my leadership team a watch and didn't buy myself a watch because I grew up in a house that was about 800 square feet, about 5 miles from here, and we did not buy watches, right? You didn't buy watches. And so I just kind of grew up that way, and I thought, yeah, that's kind of neat. I was just looking at the watch. I had been to so many jewelry stores, probably 4 or 5 jewelry stores, I hadn't bought a watch. And I'm not even talking about a nice watch. I'm talking about an $800 watch. I'm talking about a canoe with a trolling motor, right? And so I said, can I see that one? I put it on. This watch is made by the luxury division of Swatch. That's how cheap this watch is. I'm like, it's kind of a pretty watch. It's shiny. And he said, what makes you want this watch? He knew my name. He asked my name. I said, Don. He said, what makes you want this watch? I said, well, you know, I built my company past a certain point. I told myself I'd do this. It's been a couple of years. And it's just something I can give to my kids someday. Say, hey, you know, you can accomplish something if you want. Kind of a sweet thing. And he was like, man, that's like I'm getting choked up listening to you. You know, I'm like, well, yeah, you know. He goes, well, can I box it up for you? And I said, nah, you know, let me think about it. Well, I mean, he knows he's about to lose the sale, right? I'm not flying to New York City out of Tel Aviv going, honey, I got to go back and get that watch, that $800 Swatch watch. You know, so he knows this sale's walking out the door. And he says, let me get this right, Don. You built a $10 million company. You told yourself you'd buy a watch. You like this watch. You have plenty of money to buy the watch, right? I said, yeah. He goes, let me just repeat my question. Would you like for me to box this watch up for you so that you can take it on the airplane? And I looked at him and I went, yes. He was also taking the watch and going, would you like for me to box this watch up for you? That's how I felt. I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I want. He taught me something that was so amazingly valuable, and that is, instead of asking for the money, give the person permission to do what they already want to do. It's just a 100% different way of approaching the situation. They have the money, you have a solution to their problem, and all they're wondering is this the right decision? And you know, if it is, it is. And by the way, if it is not, do not sell them the product. That's how you sleep well at night. I've done it many times. People call me, hey, we want to pay all this money, have you come in and consult with us. Tell me about what you're doing. Well, this, and that. And the dynamics line up, and I said, you know what? I think you need an operations consultant, not a messaging consultant. I think your message is strong. You guys have a product problem. I am not going to be able to get you a return on your investment. Why? I don't need the money, right? I need the results. And so just don't sell it to them. There are plenty of people, though, who are not buying your product because you're saying something like, well, if you're ever interested, let me know. You know, if you're a real estate agent, never say, hey, you guys thinking about making an offer? If you'd like to make an offer, let me know. That's not how you close the sale. The way you close the sale, you say, Jim, Nancy, this house is in the school district you want. It is under budget. Nancy, 2 sinks in the master bath like you said you wanted. Jim, there is a fence around the backyard. No more wandering the streets looking for the dog at 2 in the morning in your bathrobe. This is the right house for you. You should make an offer. You want me to write it up? Because what Jim and Nancy are wondering is this the right house for me? And by the way, if they say, let us think about it, what are they going to think about? Whether or not it's the right house for them. What they need is somebody else to say, this is the right decision. This is the right decision. It's going to get you what you need. Just try it. In the last section of your email, you're going to say, I believe this is the right decision for you. Whatever you write on this email, make that the last line because you remove cognitive dissonance. And by the way, if they push back, which a percentage will, a double-digit percentage will say, I don't agree. And that's how you either, you know, close the sale or move on. But we've got to get to yes or no very quickly, and we want to affirm that they are making the right decision. All right, let's actually break this down and take a look at it as it might look in an email. If I step off this stage, is it going to make the sirens go off? If I just go right here? Okay, good. All right, so I feel like way up on this stage. I feel like Bono up here. All right, let's say you're at a cocktail party. You're at a cocktail party, you meet two people who have the exact same business. They sell the same product. They sell this, it's at the same price, and the quality is actually the same. So it's all the same thing. You got 100 people at the cocktail party, two of them do the same thing. You go up to the first person, you're making small talk, you say, well, what do you do? And they say, well, I'm an at-home chef. You know, I come to your house and I cook. You're probably going to say something like, wow, that's fascinating. Where did you go to culinary school? And where did you go to school? And what are your favorite restaurants in town? Have you ever cooked for anybody famous? You know, you're going to say, that's what you're going to talk about. And that's a great conversation. You're having a great conversation. You may be very interested because this is fascinating. You may have, you know, learned how to smoke a brisket recently and have some questions. Well, I don't know. But let's say that's not how they answer the question. You go to the second chef. You don't know what they do, but you say, hey, what do you do for a living? And they say this. Well, you know how most families don't eat together anymore, and when they do, they don't eat healthy? That's different, isn't it? Now, did he tell you what he does? No. What he did was he started with the problem, and he started with your problem. Or what he really started with was the problem of the perfect customer. And so he's going to find out really quick if you are a qualified client of his. Because if he says, you know, most families don't eat together anymore, when they do, they don't eat healthy. Anybody who has a family that doesn't eat together anymore and doesn't eat healthy is going to go, uh-huh. How many of you go, yes? Right? You already want to buy it. You don't even know what he's selling. Then we're going to position our product as the solution to the problem. We're going to paint this purple, and we're going to color code this. I am an at-home chef. I come to your house and cook. Now, how different is that conversation than the previous chef? You tell me right now, who's going to get more business? Chef one, who started with I'm an at-home chef, or chef two, who said, you know, most families don't eat together anymore, and when they do, they don't eat healthy. I'm an at-home chef. Who's going to get more business, chef one or chef two? Chef two. I've said this to 10,000 people, and nobody's ever said chef one. Chef two is not going to just do more business. They're going to do all of the business. Okay, but let's stop and try to understand why. Why is chef two already doing so much more business when they have the exact same product, exact same price, exact same quality? There's a couple reasons. One is the problem is the hook, right? I now have hooked you. Instead of telling you what I do, I start with the problem I solve, and then I position myself as the solution to that problem. It's a story structure that's ancient. Okay, the next thing that I've done is, because I started with the problem, the other thing that the problem does that's really critical is it qualifies the value of the product itself. We value everything based on how well it solves a problem. Everything. We do not value things very much that don't solve a problem. You know, for instance, you know, if you ever met somebody and, you know, you were introduced to them. You know, I've got an acquaintance named Bob Hinn. I took a class with him once. Bob Hinn invented Gore-Tex. He invented the chemical compound that lets air get through your jacket but not rain. And most people think, wow, you know, that's pretty amazing. And it is amazing. But most people don't realize that the chemical compound that creates Gore-Tex is actually used mostly in the medical industry. And Bob said one of the greatest uses of the Gore-Tex stuff is it's actually in stents that stop people from having strokes. And he said, so he actually went to the doctor, and the doctor said, Bob, I got bad news for you. We're going to have to put a stent in, because if we don't do this, you're going to have a stroke. And the doctor pulled out a little model and started showing it to him. Bob said, I'm familiar with it. I created it. He said, really? They put it in, and a week later, Bob's thing stopped him from having a stroke. That's smart. So we would all see Bob as slightly more valuable than me, for example. Yeah, I don't mean, I'm not saying that people have, you know, you're not talking about God's eyes here, but we're just talking about we do. And so each of us have an opportunity to be respected a lot more and have our products respected a lot more if we can figure out how to say, you know, a lot of people struggle with this. I got tired of seeing it. So I went into business doing this. And you are an infinitely more interesting person. And your product has value. And the worse the problem is that your product solves, the more valuable the product is. We have a dance instructor who teaches breakdancing. That's $250. A dance instructor who solves a retention problem, a culture problem, a recruitment problem, and an advertising problem through breakdancing is worth $10,000. Same freaking product. All we changed was the problem. So you got to get that first sentence right. You got to sit and figure out what and test it. Test it at cocktail parties. Test it at Starbucks. Just sit there and go, you know, if I word it this way, they go, really? Tell me more. Right? Tell me more. Then we position our product secondly. We always do it first. If you do it first, you're devaluing the product. It's a bit of a hard habit to learn because whenever people say, what do? You want to say, I'm CEO of X. Right? But if you say, well, you know, years ago, I watched people struggle with this. It drove me crazy. So I actually bought a company to do something about it, and we create this. Nobody will notice that you even did it, but they're going to be much more interested. And if they have that problem, they're going to pull out their business card and say, can you get in touch with me? Can I get on your schedule? Right? And if they don't have the problem, they're probably going to say something like, well, that's very interesting. I have an uncle who was just telling me about that, and they're struggling with that. Can I give them your number? And they would never have done that if you'd have just said what you do. So problem solution is 90% of a good sales email. Never, never write a sales email, even if it's a casual one. All right, the next thing we got to do is build a three-step plan. So let's look at what our chef does. If you want to try it, the process is really simple. First, we have a quick 30-minute meeting where I find out what your family likes to eat, what food allergies exist, and so on. Second, I come to your house and make dinner. Your family enjoys the meal without having to cook or clean up. And if you like, we take the third step, where we figure out a consistent, repeatable day of the week where I come and cook so you don't have to. Okay, what these are baby steps. Now, if you're at a cocktail party and somebody says, you know, most families don't eat together anymore, I'm an at-home chef. You want to buy that, don't you? But you're not going to. Because what happens in your subconscious is all sorts of questions start floating up, like, are you going to smell up my house? My daughter has a gluten allergy. How much does it cost? Do you come to our house and cook, or do you need to bring it? All sorts of questions that you're not going to ask at a cocktail party. So what you're going to do is you're going to say, I need to remember this guy, and then you're going to forget them. But when they do this, they give you one baby step you can take that, by the way, is free. If your first step can be free, let it be free. I come to your house and do an intake session. Now, if you've invited me into your home for a 30-minute intake session, you have actually, without spending money, invested in me, and people chase their investments. So you've invested that time. We've gotten to know each other. We're building a relationship. You're probably going to take step two, which is where I cook one meal. It's $150, and it's actually more than one meal because you're going to have leftovers for an additional meal at least, and maybe another one. You're going to discover there's great value here, right? And then, if we like each other, we take the third step. You've taken the risk and moved it back two steps, making it easier for me to take the first step. This can work in almost anything. Almost anything. Even a $5 sale, it can work. You tend to need three steps more when the product is expensive or when it's difficult to understand. Software products, all those things, three steps. The bigger the product is, the more you need those three steps. But even, we've got three brothers here who make cabinets. You say, well, what are the steps? The steps are, we come look at your kitchen, right? We measure it out. Now, you can even charge for that. You could say it's $250 for us to measure it and give you a cabinet plan. So that, at least you're not wasting money, because that is time, right? Then we give you some elevations of what your kitchen might look like. And if you like it all, we keep going. What have you just done? You've just given me a relatively risk-free way to come look at my kitchen and tell me what I'm looking at, right? For $250, pay that all day long. You know, you could have one person that's literally all they do is the $250, and then they hand it over to somebody else an account executive. So an SDR is going to charge $250 to go look at the house. You hand it to an account executive who's actually going to map it out and get the deal closed. You know, you're going to. It's a sales funnel, right? It's actually not a sales funnel. It's a product funnel. It's really nice if you can actually charge for that first one, but you don't have to. All right. Then we're going to paint the negative stakes. Now, do not be afraid of a little bit of drama, right? Let's kick them below the belt. There are only so many family dinners left before the kids go off on their own. It works. It works. The point of the negative stakes is to create urgency. And the best kind of urgency is a ticking clock. Your time is running out, right? You ever got an email saying you today's the last day to get such and such and you bought it? Yeah. Yeah, you did. All right, then we're going to paint the positive stakes. My clients sit comfortably at dinner and actually engage with each other. Day after day, they get to know each other a little better and feel supported, listened to, and cared for. And all because for at least a couple days each week, they don't have to cook. Right? So a vision of what the future could look like if you use my product. And then we're going to call the customer to action. I've got time on my schedule next week if you want to meet to talk about your family's food preferences. Do you have time next week? Yes or no question. If you're ever interested, let me know. Is not something they can accept or reject. Right? And most of us word it, if you're ever interested, let me know, because we're so afraid of rejection. Well, here's what's going to happen when you ask it in the form of a yes or no question. You are going to get rejected more than you have ever been rejected in your life. I promise you. Here's what's also going to happen. You're going to make more money than you've ever made in your life. People are going to know. And if you get over that fear, by the way, learn to mitigate that weird awkwardness of rejection. If they say, Don, I don't think I'm interested. Say, well, that makes total sense to me. It might not be for you. If you ever know anybody who needs it, let me know. By the way, I heard your kids signed up for Little League. How are they doing? And change the subject. Because what you're really afraid of is the awkwardness of rejection. But if you can learn to make rejection kind of fun for both of you, you're over the awkwardness of rejection, right? And actually, people walk away respecting you more because you asked for what you wanted and they don't know how, right? So yes or no questions. I learned this. Betsy, who is my wife, she's just the most wonderful woman in the world. We met at an Airbnb in Washington, D.C. I had flown in on a red eye, staying at this Airbnb, was working crazily. I was working in the White House that day. And I met this beautiful girl who ran this Airbnb. And I was there immediately, like most men. I was just there. Here we are. She's not impressed with anything I'd ever accomplished. Just gave me, and so afterwards, also on her desk in the Airbnb was a picture of her with an Air Force Academy graduate, and she had her arms around him, and they were in a hug, and I thought, oh, she's got a boyfriend. Turned out later it was her brother. But I didn't want to drive strong to the hoop because she's got a boyfriend and he's an Air Force graduate. I didn't even go to college, right? This guy's graduating the Air Force flying jets. I went to Alvin Community College for 2 years, home of the Fighting Dolphins. You know, it's not... I was feeling insecure. You know, like, we will splash you. You know, that's kind of all I got. So for 2 years, we emailed a little bit every few months. And finally, like, 2 years later, I was in D.C. I didn't even want to see her. I felt like I got a head cold every time I saw her, like a little heartbreak. And she ends up going out with this group. And she ends up in the group. And there we are. And she's asking questions. And I'm asking her, what's my talk? And I was just like, hey, you know, I had a couple drinks. I said, hey, are you seeing anybody? She said, yeah, I've had a boyfriend for a few years. And, you know, it's kind of going, it didn't sound like it was going really well, right? And so I said to her after two drinks, which helps close the deal. That's not in Howard's book. I mean, seriously, it's worth leaving the Baptist church to do this. What I said was, oh, sorry, I have a boyfriend. I said, in 30 days, I'm going to call you and ask you out. And if you have a boyfriend, it's going to be so weird. And then, if like, is he going to go with us? Who pays? Does he pay? Do I pay? I just feel like we should cut him loose. For his sake, this is something we are doing for him. She thought that was funny. 30 days later, I called. Doesn't have a boyfriend. I want to fly to D.C. and ask you out. And now we are married and we have a baby. And that's how you make a baby. But and then if, like the 42 years before that, absolute disaster. And part of the reason was, you know, didn't know how to just make it really clear. I was the guy going, do you like coffee? Coffee's good. I like coffee. Do you like coffee? Have you ever had coffee? Smells good. Maybe coffee. You know, it's just like, is he trying to sell me coffee? Yes or no is the point. And if we get good at that, and it really is really important to get good at the awkwardness of rejection. If you make rejection fun for the person who rejected you. Stop thinking about yourself, right? Just say, sounds like a smart decision. If that ever changes, you let me know. Because I would love to work with you, because there's something about your energy I just love. Anyway, I heard your kid sign up for Little League. Affirm them in that place, and all the awkwardness just dissipates. We want to get really, really good at that. Okay, here's the key. Use the framework that I just showed you to write follow-up emails for the next 30 days and watch what happens to your sales. Now, I mean, start writing follow-up emails. If you don't write follow-up emails, write them. If you have lunch with a potential client, or even if you spend 60 seconds on the phone with a potential client, I want you to get out your computer and email them and use that framework. Say, really great talking to you. I heard you when you said you were struggling with this. That sounds really painful. I've helped a lot of people solve that, and here's how we did it. And you can even elaborate. In fact, one person just called me this morning, and they're loving, right? And then we get to, here's how it works if you want to work with me. Step one, step two, step three. By the way, that's cut and paste, right? This is a template that you can just change. Now, be careful. Don't send it off too quickly. Make sure it's personalized, right? Otherwise, you're selling cabinets to somebody who wanted candy bars. But you know, use the framework to follow and watch what happens to your sales. How many of you, raise your hand if you have sales reps. Teach them this framework. It is chapter 3 in the book. Now, you can also go to onlinesalesscript.com. It's free. And you can actually enter your sales email into 5 different boxes and then hit preview, and it will color code it just like the one that I showed you. So you can actually look at it color coded and then just, you can actually hit a button and it'll copy that and you can put it in an email box and send it off. So you can write it very clearly. By the way, you can archive all of your sales scripts. So you can have 1,000 of them. You go, wait, I just dealt with the principal of a school last year. Where is that email? Oh, there it is, principal of school, right? And you can do it that way. It's really, really fantastic. Okay, you are getting a copy of How to Grow Your Small Business. That's right, Howard? So you don't need this. But Howard, what does this QR code do? Do you want to come up and talk? Okay, come on up and talk. I think Howard's going to do something with that QR code, but we'll talk about it in a second. How many of you feel like in the last hour, you now have the ability to make back, and I realize every session has given you this, but I just want to make sure I've covered my territory, that you now have the ability to make back in email, in closing sales, what you paid to be here? Raise your hand. That's awesome. Because sometimes you go, okay, was that worth it, right? Well, if you just got one thing, that's worth it. And I was in the previous session, you got a lot more than that. Howard, you want to talk
about it? Where's Santiago? Okay. Is that the right QR code?
For flight school?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Great.
The books are available, and if you go to the table, get the book, you can do that. If you have time to sign a few books, you're going to have to hurry because I know you're going to have to go.
I'll rifle through them.
You can get this book for free when you join flight school, and this is the news we wanted to share with you. I visited with Don here a month or so ago, mm-hmm. and he told me about flight school, and it's awesome. So let's make sure that QR code is working. Tell us about flight school. Do we have a slide on that or not?
I don't think so. I think that's the one. Hopefully that's...
It is.
Okay, it's going to flight school.
Tell us about flight school.
Okay, so what I knew would happen, because I've written enough of these books, is, and I've read enough business books, what happens is you buy a business book or somebody gives you a business book, and 50% of us are going to put it on the bedside table and not read it. That's right. And so now you're out $20 because you bought the book. Then the next part is you look at it, you go, I really need to read that. So you download it on Audible, which is fine with me because I get royalties on both. And now you're driving around, and it helps you with one or two things, and that's really, really great. And you say, okay, well, I really need to do this. But the problem is never in the information. It's always in the execution of the information. So what we did is we created something called Flight School, and we did this in my studio in Nashville. My whole coders and D&D team came up with the plan to do it. And basically what I did was I broke down in the book, there's six steps, but I broke down Flight School into 21 steps that you can take, and each of them will make you more money. So step one is creating a mission statement with three economic objectives. And like step six is, I actually put up on the giant screen behind me inside of Flight School a website that I created for a business and show you where I put the buy now buttons, why I did the header the way I did it. So what I wanted to do was create a curriculum with 21 opportunities for you to make more money as a small business owner in things that almost everybody in the room can do all 21. The goal with Flight School, and I'm pretty excited about this, is within 6 months, so you get one a week. Now, you can binge watch it if you want, but you do get one a week that is emailed to you. It leads you back into the platform, and you watch it. There is a robust system of software that allows you to create these brand scripts, sales scripts, all your leadership meetings. It actually has a cash flow calculator, so it shows beakers where your money flowing in and out of beakers and stuff like this. It's a pretty cool system. This is where the artist comes in, because the artist is willing to spend the money. My wife is like, do you know how much those beakers are costing? I don't want to know. The beakers will flow. Anyway, so you know all that stuff is in there, but the goal, and I stated in the very first video, is to double your revenue. And I promise that you, I don't promise, but I say you can do that if you're a sub $1 million company. If you're over $1 million, you're going to see an 80%, 60%, 40%, because it just takes a lot longer to double a $20 million business. Yeah. So you know, we got to get real about that. But what I want is at the end of 6 months, a significant increase in your run rate. And there's so, just your website alone, right? If we get your website right, if your sales team knows how to do what I just taught you, you know, all of the compound interest on those ideas is significant. So we launched it about a week ago, and we have hundreds of small business owners already in it. We're already starting to hear a little bit of results, and we're super excited about it. But that is brand new. And then Howard, actually, you can go through it with just me on your computer screen, or you can join a Flight School group, and then Howard is providing the coaching. We've certified these guys to do the coaching to get you through it. But when Governor Haslam said to me, you need to professionalize your operation, I needed to hand me a book, and he needed to hand me a password and login to Flight School. And so I created that so that you guys can just do this step by step. If you have a leadership team, you want to get together 8 a.m. Monday morning, and the videos are between 5 and 25 minutes, depending on what we're dealing with that week, and just that is your growth plan in the next 6 months as we have a 67% chance of going into a recession. And if you run this growth plan during a recession, my hope is that nobody in this room would have a smaller business at the end of it. It is actually possible to grow during a recession. 85% of my business was dependent on people getting on airplanes and flying to Nashville when COVID shut the world down, right? So I'm looking at an 85% reduction in revenue. So I'm laying almost everybody off, right? Got our team together, said, we actually put an X on the calendar 1 year from that date. Turned out we should have put it 2 years from that date, but 1 year from that date. And I said to my team, I said, on that day, we're all going to get together. We're going to have a very expensive bottle of wine, and we're going to toast the fact that we laid nobody off.
Amen.
And they all looked at me and went, wow, how are we going to do that? And then I looked at them and I said, I don't know how we're going to do that. Anybody have any ideas? You wouldn't believe how good the ideas were. 30% increase in revenue, 25% increase in profit. 1 year later, we stood and we looked at that calendar and we gave each other a toast. It only happens, but listen, it doesn't happen with wishful thinking. It happens when you execute a plan. So flight plan is a plan.
Yeah.
Flight school is a plan.
It's a phenomenal system. It's brilliant. So you can get flight plan. It's $24.95.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
$24.95. It's basically a 6-month program. And a couple of things are going to happen. First of all, you get your book for free. So if you go when you go on the QR code right there, go ahead and sign up. Just show Michelle your receipt, okay, that you paid. You get your book. Donald's going to be right back there.
I'll autograph those before I go. I got a Southwest airline pilot right now who's entering coordinates into a plane.
Right, yeah. And so the other thing that's going to happen is we're going to do a mastermind around this. So when you join flight school, you're going to be able to get into this special mastermind that we're doing so that we can walk you through it. It's a phenomenal framework. So,
basically,
do yourself a favor.
Howard, like once a week, there's a Zoom call where you can ask questions about it.
Yes.
And there's also, in flight school, is me or a member of my team once a month that you'll have access to that on a Zoom call, and I'll answer your questions as well as you go through it. So you get access to Howard's team once a week and me and my team once a month as part of that.
Awesome.
Great.
Give it up for Donald Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate you.
Yeah, I'd love to.